Om Tai Chi Tai Tui Swaha. They can be. Yeah.
Welcome, everyone. Thank you for being here. I am so grateful for the causes and conditions that have occurred for all of us to be here in this moment right now. I feel very, very honored and humbled. My name is Romy, and I'm happy to introduce you all to the Community Meditation Center here at Spirit Rock. I have a few quick announcements before we begin, and the first one is, if you have a cell phone, would you please make sure it is completely turned off? That would be really lovely. And if you would like an assisted hearing device, they're right there in the back of the room, and when I'm done speaking, I'd be happy to get you one. I'd just like for you all to know we have a bookstore on the other side of the hall, and we have Jetsuma's books there, so please come by and see us at the end of the event. And also, the nuns have brought some books that are freely offered, and they are in the tea area, and you are welcome to pick them up as they last. So today is a Dana day, which means the teachings are generously offered for free. So if you feel compelled, there are Dana baskets in the back of the hall. And if you make a donation, it is split between Spirit Rock and the nunnery, DGL Nunnery. And I'm sure someone will pronounce the name of the nunnery correctly.
You got something.
Oh, okay. What she said. I'm now going to announce or introduce Aya Anand Bodhi, who will introduce our very special guest today. Thank you.
Thank you. So very very honored to be able to welcome Venerable Jetsunma Tenzin Palmer to Spirit Rock. She's just been teaching a retreat up at the big hall with Aya Santachitta and myself supporting. So very happy that she can also come here for anyone who wasn't able to get into that retreat. Jetsuma Tenzin Palmer, she's currently the most senior Western nun in the Tibetan tradition and one of the first to have ordained way back. And she's the founder of DGL Nunnery, which is a nunnery of about 108 nuns. How old is the youngest?
Now about 7.
So aged between 7 and 25-ish, I think.
No, now the oldest one's about 40.
40, okay. And girls have come to the nunnery as young as 4 with the intention to ordain and train there. So kind of think about that for a moment. 108 nuns aged between 7 and 40 is quite something. And Venerable is training these nuns as yoginis. It's an ancient practice that was pretty much almost lost for the women, and she's reviving that for women in the Himalayan regions. And she was given the title Jetsunma by her teacher, and that title means something along the lines of Reverend Master. It's a very high title, and very few nuns have been given that, so it's a great honour to receive that. She's also passionate about supporting nuns, and is the president of the Sakyaditta GAT conference, which is every 2 years a conference of Buddhist women worldwide from all lineages that gathers in different countries. So Jetsunma does a lot of work in support of women in the Dharma, and the fruits of that is for all beings. So it's a real honour to have her here. And I think you probably all know about some other things, the cave in the snow. And there's other history that we don't need to go into because you'll have read the book probably already. But I'd like to now hand over and thank you for being here.
Thank you, Anand Bodhi. So thank you, everybody, for making the effort to come here. It's such a beautiful place. So this afternoon we are going to go through a text of what is called Lojong, a very common Lojong text, Lojong only 8 verses. So this kind of Lojong literally means mind training, but it's more to do with training our attitude, training our way that we respond to circumstances which happen to us, especially adverse circumstances. So this kind of, the idea is that we take everything onto the path. You know, people think when things are going well and, you know, we're healthy and happy and everything is on the up and up, then this is a good time to practice. And when we are faced with very difficult, adverse circumstances, difficult people, bad health and so forth, that somehow our practice gets dropped and overlooked or postponed. So these Lojong teachings were about how to take everything, and especially adverse circumstances, onto the path, to use everything that happens to us, and especially difficult things which happen to us, as a means of maturing, inwardly maturing, of really becoming inwardly strong. I sometimes compare it to if we go to a gymnasium, then, you know, you go to a gymnasium and the trainer looks at you and says, well, your arms are not bad, but your legs very flabby. And so you go on machines and work. And the reason to work hard on those machines is to become strong. We don't resent those machines because they challenge us. If they're too easy, we find a more difficult machine or up the difficulty. We recognize that the efforts which we make to have a workout on these machines is the reason why we can then, clearing away all the sweat and having a shower, we now have nice strong legs. So it's like that. Somebody one time said that life is the gymnasium of the soul. So even though we don't have souls in Buddhism, nonetheless, the idea is a good one. That this is where we have our workout. This is where we train. It shouldn't be too easy. Right? So this kind of attitude and these kinds of teachings were brought into Tibet in the 11th century by a great Bengali scholar called Palnatisha. He was he had studied this kind of thinking in Indonesia, in Sumatra, for about 12 or more years with a master there. And then he came back. He was the abbot of the very large monastic college of Vikramashila. And he was requested to go to Tibet. And there's a whole story about it, but we don't really have time because we have to get through the verses of why he finally went to Tibet. But one of the reasons was because the Buddha Thara told him to go. And he said, no, you know, I'm too old. And she said, no, you've got to go. For their benefit, you must go. Even though it will shorten your life, it will be a great benefit for many beings. So he went to Tibet in around the 11th century, early 11th century, and he had an enormous impact because Buddhism at that time was going through a lot of confusion, basically, with a lot of emphasis on psychic powers and these kind of... Milarepa came just after that. A lot of confusion about how to practice the path from the basics upwards. And so Atisha really set them very clear, especially much emphasis on the importance of refuge in the Three Jewels and bodhicitta, the aspiration to attain enlightenment for the sake of all beings. So this he pushed very, very much. And along with that, these kind of teachings on how to take everything onto the path. And his followers likewise carried this on. So these eight verses here are by somebody called Langri Thangpa. I'm going to, in the Tibetan tradition, before we study a text, we have to get the oral transmission. So we're not supposed to study a text until we've had the transmission given by someone who themselves has the transmission, who themselves had the transmission, all the way back to the author. It's like a candle. Everybody lights a candle all the way down. So I will give you the oral transmission here. Hold on. I mean, Tibetans go brrrr. I can't do that. So, Kadambi geshe langri tamba doji sengi zepi lo chansi je mashu so. Dani senchen tamche la yishin norbo lehlak pe. Tun chen dupi samba yi tatu je pa zimpa shu. Kantu su dang tropi se. Dani kun le. Menta shing, shen la san patapa yi chu du che pa zimba shu. Cho lang kuntu rong ju la to pa nyu mon che ma ta, da shen mar rong che pa na, sen ta du ne do pa shu. Rong shi ngen pe sen chen ne du nga dwa po nun tun se rin chen te dan tre pa yin, nye pa ka we che zin shu. Dala shenji tuato gi shekur laso mirik pe. Chongka rongi limpa dong cha ken shen la bulwa sho. Kan la dani pento pe rewa che wa kanshi gi. Shintu mire dunse nang shenyen dampa ta wa sho. Do na ngur dan jupa yi pende ma nam kun la bul. Ma yi nu dan dungal kun sangwe da la limpa sho. Deda kunchan chu che ji, tope rime ma pang shing, chukun, juma shepi lu, shime chingwa le do shu. So in English, that is, wishing to attain enlightenment for the sake of all sentient beings who excel even the wish-fulfilling jewel, may I constantly cherish them all. Wherever Nava I am in the company of others, may I consider myself least important, and from the depths of my heart cherish others and hold them supreme. In all activities may I examine my mind, and as soon as disturbing emotions arise, endangering myself and others, may I firmly face and avert them. Whenever I see ill-natured people overwhelmed by strong misdeeds and sufferings, may I cherish them as something rare, as though I had found a treasure trove. When others, out of envy, mistreat me with slander and abuse, may I take defeat upon myself and offer the victory to them. Even if someone whom I have helped and in whom I have placed my hopes, does great wrong by harming me, may I see them as an excellent spiritual friend. In brief, directly or indirectly, may I give all help and joy to my mothers, and may I take all their harm and pain secretly upon myself. May none of this ever be sullied by thoughts of the eight worldly concerns. May I understand all things as illusions and, without attachment, gain freedom from bondage. Okay, so I'm sorry you don't have copies of the text, but I will go through each verse so you will understand what we are commenting on. So the first verse says, wishing to attain enlightenment for the sake of all sentient beings who excel even the wish-fulfilling jewel, may I constantly cherish them all. So the wish-fulfilling jewel, of course, is a feature of Indian mythic tradition. It is considered to be a jewel owned by the gods that every time you want something, it will manifest. So you want ice cream, ice cream. You want gold, gold. You want a big diamond, big diamond. Whatever you happen to want, a nice big Ferrari, bright red, you've got it. Anything. in the world. But it cannot give us spiritual gifts. It cannot give us enlightenment. It cannot give us insight. It can only give mundane benefits. So therefore, wishing to attain enlightenment, we are wishing to attain enlightenment for the sake of all sentient beings. Now those sentient beings, which means all beings, not just human beings, but animals, birds, insects, fish, any beings that live in the waters or under or above the earth or in the sky or wherever throughout the universe. Beings seen, beings unseen, on all levels. These are all sentient beings. So we are aspiring to attain to awakening in order to help to awaken all sentient beings, because, like us, all beings are trapped in the prison house of samsara. So if we can find the way out, we cannot just leave by ourselves. We have to open the door and help shepherd everybody else out too. So this aspiration, why are we practicing? We are practicing in order to get to the point where we can genuinely be of benefit for others. It's as if, you know, well, everybody's sick, so we go out and we become trained to become a doctor. And we go through college and we go through all the training to be a doctor. Why do we want to be a doctor? Just so that if I get sick, I can treat myself? No. We train to be a doctor in order to be able to benefit everybody else who is sick. If we don't know ourselves how to deal with sickness, even the best intention, we will end up, you know, creating a lot of problems for people. In order to cure people of their sickness, first we have to find out how to do that. We have to graduate as doctors. So likewise, the aspiration is we want to benefit all beings, and what we can do while we're working on the path, we can do. But ultimately, the best thing we can possibly do for everybody is to completely break the wheel of samsara, to open up the doors of the prison. So this is the aspiration called bodhicitta, which is the first thing that Atisha really pushed when he went to Tibet. He said, you're doing all these fantasy practices for the sake of your own benefit. You're only doing this in order to genuinely be able to serve all beings. So all these sentient beings are not an obstacle to our enlightenment. These sentient beings are like a wish-fulfilling gem. They're superior to a wish-fulfilling gem, because through cultivating the qualities of the heart needed for the bodhisattva path to awakening, we need other beings. How are we going to cultivate our loving kindness, our compassion, our patient endurance, our generosity, and all these other qualities of the heart if we don't have people to practice on? Right? I mean, we can sit in solitude and think, may all beings be well and happy. And then somebody comes outside and makes a noise, like, I'm doing my loving kindness meditation, shut up. So we need other beings. Otherwise, we cannot know how we're really advancing, because if we're only seeing ourselves in the mirror, it's not enough. We need other people to mirror us. So therefore, why are we doing all this? We're doing this to attain awakening or enlightenment for the sake of all these other beings. Because why? Because these other beings are more precious than a wish-fulfilling jewel, because they are the means by which I can wake up. So a wish-fulfilling jewel might be giving me ice cream and Ferraris, but it's not giving me enlightenment. which other beings can do. So they are very, very precious. All beings are precious. And therefore may I constantly cherish them all. Means may I constantly... I just look what the tattoo chepa. Yeah. So cherish them, hold them dear. All beings. But especially difficult beings. It's very easy for us to love all beings, meaning our family, our partner, our children, our parents, our best friends. But it's very easy to be loving towards people who are lovable. That doesn't really take too much effort. If people are kind and friendly towards us, we are likely to be kind and friendly back, which is good, but it's not enough. So, whenever I am in the company of others, may I consider myself least important and from the depths of my heart cherish others and hold them supreme. Now, the actual Tibetan, this is a somewhat, what shall I say? It's a rendered translation here because this line upsets people. The Tibetan actually says, may I see myself as inferior to all other beings and other beings as higher and more important than myself. So the question is, in Tibet on the whole, people had very high self-esteem. Even quite humble people felt at ease within themselves. This was one of the reasons when the Tibetans came out from Tibet as refugees, they were such an exemplary refugee group. Because having lost everything and seen the most horrific things happening and then all the months they spent trying to escape, nonetheless, on the whole and generally speaking, they were not as traumatized as they should have been. And they were still cheerful and kind and very open and very optimistic for what they were going to do and accomplish in the future. So one of the reasons for this was their incredibly deep faith. And when they escaped, then also many high lamas escaped too. So they had their lamas with them. And so therefore they have tremendous devotion to the Dharma. And so that kept them very strong. But also because they had a strong, I think really a very strong sense of well-being inside themselves. So that even when external circumstances were so adverse, nonetheless, inwardly, they were still very, very strong. And of course, this text was written by some big abbot sitting on his high throne, to all the other abbots and others. So to say, look on yourself as inferior, was a very interesting way for these big abbots to look at themselves, right? Because they are always in a superior position. And also the monks that they would have been talking to were in society in a superior position. Therefore, to encourage them to feel inferior was good for them, right? You understand what I'm saying? So therefore, the actual text says, whenever I am in the company of others, may I consider myself as the most inferior. But here it's translated as, may I consider myself least important. And I think that this is the point. Many of you know the story of when His Holiness the Dalai Lama, he has these mind and science conferences every year. He's very fascinated, especially by neuroscience and quantum physics and the affinities they have with Buddhist philosophy and practice. And so at one time, he was in a meeting with these very eminent neuroscientists and psychologists. And His Holiness must have been talking about one of these texts and about how in the company of others one sees oneself as most inferior. And so somebody, one of these eminent psychiatrists or neuroscientists said, yes, but what about low self-esteem? And His Holiness looked blank. What? And he said, well, what about low self-esteem and self-hatred? Never heard of that one. So he asked his translator, what's he talking about? And the translator tried to presumably translate low self-esteem in Tibetan, of which there is no word. And so His Holiness thought, then he said, I think very rare, very rare. And so this eminent neuroscientist turned to his eminent colleagues and said, who ever suffers from low self-esteem and self-hatred? And they all put up their hands. And I think for His Holiness that was a revelation, because, you know, Westerners always appear like we know it all. And we go around the world, especially Americans, with all due respect, telling everybody else how they should do things. And, present this facade of total confidence and belief in themselves. And it's only when you take off that mask that you find underneath there is so much low self-esteem, inner criticisms, a sense of inner failure and so forth that is masked by this persona of total confidence, to the point that His Holiness the Dalai Lama's main translator, Geshe Thupten Jinpa, when he started in America to teach about the four Brahmaviharas of loving kindness, compassion, joy and equanimity, he, in traditional Buddhist way of practicing, we start first with giving loving kindness and compassion to ourselves, then to those we love, feel neutral about, don't like, and to everybody in general. And he discovered, to his own surprise, that these Americans could not love themselves. They had tremendous resistance to giving themselves loving kindness and compassion. So then he had to change it round and say, start with somebody you love. Start with your partner, your children, your parents, your pet dog, whoever you love. Just give them loving kindness. Just imagine how wonderful it would be if they were happy and free from suffering. Then when you feel that warm glow inside, turn it on yourself. So, therefore, rather than translate this as being most inferior, oh, look at me, I'm hopeless, I'm stupid, they're so wonderful, me, I'm useless. That, when we already have low self-esteem, just makes us have lower self-esteem and end up depressed. That's not what is intended. Right? In Buddhism, pride means thinking we are superior to other people, but it also means thinking we're inferior to other people. Because if I think, oh, I'm the most stupid person here, I'm hopeless, I can't do anything, all these people, they're so wonderful. When you're in retreat, everybody else is deep in the first jhana, or at least some samadhi. I'm the only one that's being caught up in all our wandering thoughts. That is not humility. That's just the inverse of the ego beating itself up. The ego is very happy to be miserable. Because if we are miserable, especially full of self-pity about how awful and hopeless and stupid I am, what are we thinking about? Me, 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 poor me, defeat me. Oh, hopeless me. Me. Isn't it? And then we hire therapists and sit there talking about me. If our sense of self is healthy, we don't have to think about ourselves so much because we're thinking about others. We can get off our own back. So, therefore, here where he translates this by saying, whenever I'm in the company of others, may I consider myself least important, I think is the point. When we meet with other people, the other people are more important. The other person, the other people, they are what we are putting our attention on, not what are they thinking about me. Do they like me? Don't they like me? Do I give a good impression? Do they think I'm stupid? Blah, 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 blah. You know, then we're trapped in our ego. And we cannot see the other person because we're too busy talking to ourselves about ourselves. Do you understand? So the point when we meet with others is that that other person, whoever it is, at that moment is the most important person in the world because that's the person we're with. So then we get out of the way. And we look at the other person. We hear them. So essentially that's what he's saying. He's saying in the company of others, just get out of the way. That person, whoever we are with, they are the most important people at that moment because they're who we're with. So, and from the depths of my heart, cherish others and hold them supreme. In other words, all beings want to be well and happy. They don't want to suffer. We might have very strange ideas on where lies our happiness, but nonetheless, essentially, we would all rather feel well inside than to be suffering. We all hold this in common. In addition, as the Buddha said, to each one, his own self is most dear. In other words, each one is the center of their own little universe until we gain awakening. But one way to help dissolve that total preoccupation on ourselves is to cherish others as most dear, most important. Because, like me, I would rather be happy and not miserable. Everybody would rather be happy and not miserable. Animals would rather be happy and not miserable. Insects would rather be happy and not miserable. Who would? And there are so many more other beings. There's only little me. So other beings are more important. I mean, if you think about it, it makes sense. If we go about the world cherishing other beings and wishing them to be happy. Like, you know, we could be sitting in a... You know, people are always complaining they have no time to practice. What nonsense. We're sitting in a plane, or we're sitting in a train, or we're sitting in a traffic jam, surrounded by all these other beings. Imagine sending out rays of light and golden light of love and just soaking into all these beings in the carriage. Oh. I'm not looking very happy about it. Give them love. Just imagine that suddenly their hearts are filled with joy, inner joy. Wouldn't that be wonderful? All these beings would love to feel inner joy. Wish it for them. Imagine it. And all these lights. I mean, you don't have to sit up on your chair cross-legged, you know, while you're driving, especially not. Just relax. But just imagine it. How beautiful if all these beings would be well and happy and free from suffering. All their problems solved. Happy, happy. We cherish all beings. Each being is totally important to themselves. So remembering that, we give them love and wish them well. So, in all activities, may I examine my mind, and as soon as disturbing emotions arise, endangering myself and others, may I firmly face them and avert them. Okay? So, during our formal sitting, when we are sitting in our meditations, if we are observing the mind, which is really an excellent thing to do, we are just watching the mind streaming by. Like the traditional example is of someone sitting on the banks of the river, just watching the river going by. We're not plunging in the river and being swept along as we normally would be. Now we are sitting back on the banks. Or as one Lama, Gokensa Rinpoche, he described it as sitting in a train and watching all the scenery go by. Beautiful scenery, unpleasant scenery, whatever scenery, we observe it, but we don't reach out and grasp it. We're sitting in the train. So, like that, right? So, during our formal meditation, when we sit, we do not judge our thoughts. We do not discriminate our thoughts. All thoughts and feelings are just thoughts and feelings. They're just empty energy. They're not me. They're not mine. We recognize the totally impermanent nature of all our conceptual thinking. And at the same time, we develop the quality of being mindful, of being more aware, of being more conscious of what's going on in the mind. So the two things are going on at the same time. But during the day, not during our formal meditations when we're just letting things go by, but during the day, then in all our activities, we should still be aware of our mind. We should observe the mind at all times. So even if we can't manage at all times, we can manage as often as we can remember. When I first started practicing with the yogis in our monastery, they suggested every hour making a commitment to observe the mind three times. So, you know, right, we make the commitment that every hour, three times, I will remember just to look at what the mind is doing in this moment. What am I thinking? What am I feeling in this moment? And then gradually, as we begin to do that, then the ability to become more conscious, more awake, more present grows. So, during the day, therefore, as soon as a disturbing emotion arises, that means the disturbing emotion means the kleshas. As soon as a negative emotion, such as anything based on the roots of anger or greed or envy, pride, or any negative emotion which disturbs the mind, as soon as we recognize that, then we should face it, recognize it. The underlying feeling here is anger or aversion, irritation, annoyance, or the underlying feeling tone here is greed or grasping attachment and so forth, or whatever is that negative underpinning of the emotion, which creates a lot of problems for ourselves and for everybody else, because it says in all activities, may I examine my mind before doing anything. In other words, he's saying, before we undertake any action, we should look and see what is the underlying motivation, what is the underlying intention here. Because as the Buddha said, karma is intention, right? It's not so much what we do, but why we do it. Yes? I mean, to take an extreme example, I could be a murderer who takes up a sharp knife, a scalpel, and I plunge that in somebody's chest, into their heart, and they die. And the underlying motivation is hatred or whatever, jealousy or whatever it is that caused them to want to harm this person. Or I could be a highly skilled surgeon who likewise takes up the scalpel, likewise thrusts it into their chest in order to do a heart operation, but unfortunately it fails and the patient dies. But the motivation of the surgeon was very different. The motivation of the surgeon was to help and cure the person, not to harm them and kill them. So although essentially the action was the same and the result was the same, the person died, nonetheless, the karmic results would be very different because the intention was entirely different. And this is why it's very important for us when we are undertaking an action to see as honestly as possible what is the underlying intention behind us performing this action or of body or speech. Because like when people are quarreling with each other, then later they might repeat the words that they said. But all I said was da-da-da-da-da-da-da. But at the time, the underlying motive and the tone was therefore very negative. It wasn't the words, it was how it was said and with what intention it was said. That is what counts. So therefore, we should be very careful of what is actually going on in our mind during the day. Because what we think is will result in our speech and our actions. So if we want our speech and actions to be pure and beneficial, then we should be very careful that the underlying motivation is likewise pure and beneficial. So if we see that there is negativity there, we should recognize it, right? He says, as soon as disturbing emotions arise, endangering myself and others, because from disturbing emotions, we then act unskillfully and cause a lot of problems for ourselves and for others. And we make bad karma, and in general, we mess up. So we need to be very conscious of what's going on in our mind. If our mind is completely harmless, genuinely harmless, and in a beneficial state of mind, it's very unlikely that we will act then unskillfully to harm either ourselves or others. I mean, we always blame others, but really the problem lies within. Endangering myself and others, may I firmly face and avert the negative emotions. So first we have to look at them. We have to see them, recognize them. If aversion of any kind, anger, greed, pride, jealousy, fear, any of these negative emotions, the moment they arise, then if we look at them straight in the face, we can recognize what that emotion is, and in this way, we can decide how to deal with it. much of Buddhism is about how to deal with the five afflictive emotions on all levels. Throughout all Buddhist schools, up to Vajrayana, Dzogchen, anywhere you want to go, of course, in the Theravadin school and Mahayana school, all of it is dealing with how to uproot our negative emotions, how to cultivate our positive emotions, and how to attain to that which transcends both, which is our original Buddha nature or the unconditioned. So, therefore, how first we have to recognize a negative emotion has arisen. We have to face it. We can't pretend that's not really a negative emotion. It is a negative emotion, okay? And then, depending on our practice and the level of our skill, we deal with it. For example, if it's anger, we suddenly find ourselves very angry, then we could try replacing anger by patience, by patient endurance, by arousing compassion and loving kindness, by looking that anger in the very face and transforming it into its essential nature of a very energetic mirror-like wisdom. Or, as Shantideva says, if we're really angry and we can't at that point change the anger into a more positive emotion, then we should act like a piece of wood. You know, just not react. Breathing in, breathing out, right? Counting to 10. But, and then we're going to pick up a book on how to deal with anger. But the point is that everybody has negative emotions. If we didn't have any negative emotions at all, it would mean that we were totally egoless, in which case we would be arahats, which is wonderful, great if you are. But for most people, they're not quite there yet. We all have faults. We all have problems. If it's not one thing, it's another. Having negative emotions in itself is not the problem, because everybody has something. If we didn't, we wouldn't need a path. But the point is to recognize our negative emotions and then apply the antidotes. As long as we're in denial that we have any problem, it's everybody else that's the problem, then nothing will change and we will become more and more habituated to our negative emotions and reactions. Once we recognize what the problem is, we say, okay, now I can get to work. Whatever our problem is, there is an antidote to that. It's like if we're sick and we're in denial that we're sick, then we just get sicker. But if we are sick and then we discover what is the actual cause of our problem, then there's probably a good cure. So this is why it's very important to observe the mind throughout the day as much as possible in all our actions and recognize what is the underlying thoughts and feelings going on at this particular point. If they are negative, to recognize that and change them. If they are positive or neutral, okay, no problem. Wherever I see ill-natured people overwhelmed by strong misdeeds and sufferings, may I cherish them as something rare, as though I had found a treasure trove. So the idea here, again, I said the Lojong is to take things which are normally regarded as an obstacle and take it as an opportunity. This is not some New Age stuff. This is genuine Buddha Dharma. I mean, in fact, I remember one time going to a very traditional Lama who had never been to the West. And I was moaning and groaning to him about all the problems I was having, all my obstacles. And he said exactly that. If you say obstacle, it's an obstacle. If you say opportunity, it's an opportunity. It all depends on how we take it. So we need to develop compassion, loving kindness, patience, generosity with the behavior of others, an open, flexible mind, an open heart. How can we learn if everyone does and says everything we want other people to say and do? Then we think, aren't I lovely? I'm such a kind, friendly person. Everybody loves me and I love everybody. But we only love everybody because everybody loves us. Which is very nice, but we don't learn anything. The reason why the celestial realms, the God realms, are regarded as a spiritual dead end is because everything there is lovely. We have bodies of light. We have wish-fulfilling trees and wish-granting gems. Anything we want, we can get. We all have beautiful bodies of light. Everybody's love, 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 peace, peace, peace. Naughty. So in the celestial realms, everybody is beautiful, everybody never ages, everybody, everything you want is naturally given. So as long as the good karma which created that rebirth lasts, it's all very lovely. But everything is impermanent. And even the highest celestial realms are still within the wheel of samsara. So when that merit bank begins to decline, we're not making any interest on all our merit there. And when it runs out, then we have to come down again. And we haven't learned anything. People, when everything goes beautifully, don't have much incentive to practice. Why bother to practice? I'm having a great time. Right? So what is the incentive to practice? Like a whip. There's the carrot that, you know, well, we will feel better, we will feel more, you know, at ease within ourselves, we will genuinely be able to be of more benefit for other sentient beings and so forth. That's the carrot. But the whip, the stick, is the difficulties in our daily life. They are the things which urge us on to develop a whole different relationship with adverse circumstances and difficult people. That's what's going to help us to genuinely learn compassion and patient endurance and kindness and generosity. So therefore, whenever I see ill-natured people overwhelmed by their strong misdeeds and sufferings, may I cherish them as something rare, as though I had found a treasure trove. These are exactly the people who are going to help on my practice. People who are difficult, people who challenge us in any way. These are the people who are going to be helping us on the spiritual path. So rather than avoid that, we are grateful for them, for their health. And helping us to cultivate these qualities which we couldn't cultivate if people were not difficult, if circumstances were not difficult. How are we going to learn? If we don't exercise, we're never going to get strong limbs. We're never going to get muscles. We're going to be inside spiritually flabby. You know, we can manage when everything is nice and pleasant and the road is nice and beautifully tarmacked. But the minute it gets a bit bumpy, with pit holes and things, we can't drive, we can't move. So this is the most important point he's putting out. So he gives an example. When others, out of envy or whatever, mistreat me with slander and abuse, they say bad things about us, they're nasty, they use harsh language, they criticize us or they say bad things about us. When others, out of envy, mistreat me with slander and abuse, may I take defeat upon myself and offer the victory to them. So normally, when we are in opposition with others, our main objection is to crush them and be victorious. So here, they're turning the whole thing around and thinking, if they want to be victorious, let them be victorious. May they be happy. I will take the defeat. That's all right. Doesn't harm me. If you want it, you have it. A friend of ours in Australia, she was having, her father had been very, very wealthy. And then when he died, of course, there was this big tussle among the siblings about the will. And she herself lived very modestly, though she's an extremely talented woman. But her brother was very wealthy. He was a businessman. And so although the property and the money had all been divided half and half, he said that she shouldn't have it because she wasn't living where the father was, and therefore he should have it all. And so he wanted to take her to court about this and contest the will. This is so common. I cannot tell you how many people are in court contesting wills of their forebears. Anyway, in this case, she thought, honestly and truthfully, do I want to go to court? He is very wealthy. He's going to employ very top lawyers. I can only, afford the least. Then I have to keep going through court for weeks, months, maybe years. It's going to cost a fortune. It's going to create so much acrimony between us. For the sake of what? True, I don't have much money, but so what? I have enough. If it will make him happy to have all this extra money when he already has so much, then may he be well and happy. And she said, no, it's all yours. Take it. And so she was fine. She just went on with her life, and she's still going on with her life. And I don't know what the brother's doing. I doubt if he's any happier for having, a few million more. But she was free because she remembered this verse. Take the defeat unto yourself and give the victory to others. So she said, okay, you can have the victory. But it wasn't a victory. She got the victory, really, because she was free. She didn't have all the worries of going through court cases for the sake of just money. And her brother presumably felt self-satisfied and happy, so that's very nice. I'm glad he's happy. So it becomes a win-win situation. I've often thought that when you see, like, in sports, I mean, you have two teams or two players. One is bound to win, one is bound to lose. So, if when they had the person that wins, then we're all very happy for them. But then the people that lose, if they rejoiced in the victory of the others, then everybody would be happy. Right? So if the other team also applauded the ones that lost, and the ones that lost applauded the ones that won, then everybody would win. Do you see? I mean, it's us ourselves who think, what is winning and losing? If we can just hand over the victory to others, then we've won. Do you understand? This does not mean, obviously, in all of these verses, it doesn't mean, I mean, because we always want to win. You're in an argument, you want to win. You want to flatten the other one. I mean, come on. It's so childish. Human beings, I tell you. This obviously does not mean that if one is in abusive situations that one just allows the abuse to take place, or if one is in the face of someone who is seriously trying to cheat us or do us harm, that we just allow them to get away with it because, you know, karmically it's also very bad apart from the fact we don't need to be injured. I mean, but in that case, what we need is a kind of fearless compassion, which deals with that situation, that very negative situation, not with anger or with fear, but fearlessly, but from a compassionate heart, recognizing that the other person is causing a lot of problems for themselves and for others and has to be stopped. Doesn't mean that we are... Patient endurance in itself is a strength. It's not a weakness. Getting upset and angry and wanting to fight back, that's weak. But having the ability to stand back, look at the situation, and decide from an inner poise what would be the most skillful way to deal with this situation, that's not weakness. So many of the times, the most skillful way is just to say, all right, you win, and walk away. There's no problem there. They're happy, you're happy, everybody's happy, isn't it? Even if it gets worse, even if someone whom I have helped and in whom I place my hopes does great wrong by me, by harming me, may I see them as an excellent spiritual friend. Right? So even somebody whom we trust, and maybe in the past we have been helpful towards, if they turn against us and try to harm us through their speech or their actions, instead of getting all upset, right? Instead of, you know, feeling upset and self-pitying or wanting to get our own revenge, instead of that, we can see them as our most precious spiritual friend. In fact, in some texts it says we should place them on our head, like, you know, the Buddha or the Lama. Why? Because they are teaching us that most difficult of qualities, patient endurance or forbearance, patience, which is one of the qualities needed on the bodhisattva path towards awakening or Buddhahood. We absolutely have to practice patience, patient endurance, and we cannot do that unless somebody or something upsets us. Right? So if somebody upsets us and makes us feel angry, instead of wanting to get our own back, we can say, oh, thank you. You're so kind. You're so absolutely obnoxious. I'm so grateful. Without you, how could I practice this most precious quality? So really, you are like my teacher. You are mirroring to me my own shortcomings. Because you say something I don't like, I get all upset and angry. The problem is not you. Here, the problem is me. I am going to learn how to cultivate loving kindness, compassion, and patience in the face of your abuse or your, you know, hurtful actions. If we can do that, It's not impossible. This is not totally idealistic. I mean, one of the examples one could give is when, you know, after the communist invasion, when so many lamas and teachers and monks and nuns, of course, who were horribly tortured, were put in prison. They haven't done anything. It's just they happened to be, you know, where they were at that time. And, you know, so they were in prison 20 years, 30 years. They've only, you know, in the last few years been released. And many of them were in hard labor camps. Many of them were interrogated and tortured. And when finally they were let out, released from these prisons, what was so amazing, I mean, I met a number of them, and I'm sure Aileen did likewise, and some of them are here now in America. They were so radiant. They were just shining. Their eyes were brilliant with love and compassion. And they were just so joyful. And everybody, well, but you've just been in a hard labor camp for 30 years. And they said, well, it was like being in retreat. I heard someone say exactly that. 25 years he was in prison. It was like a retreat. The Dalai Lama asked one of these, what did you fear most when you were in prison? And he said, and others have echoed likewise, he said, what I feared most was losing my compassion for my tormentors. And clearly he didn't. Because he came out just radiant with love. Everybody feels it when you meet these people. They're just so, just glowing. So none of us are likely to end up in hard labor camps or being tortured and interrogated like that. Year after year after year for nothing. You haven't done a thing. But they didn't spend their time resenting, planning revenge, or even beating themselves up, thinking what bad karma they had made to be in such a situation. They use that situation to cultivate all the qualities which up to then they had been studying and debating. Now they had to put them into practice. And so they were grateful to their tormentors. Without them, how would I have learned, they said. It was so helpful on the path. So these are present day examples. This is not some kind of, you know, fantasy world we're living in. How to take the most difficult circumstances onto the path, making it at the path. In brief, directly or indirectly, may I give all help and joy to my mothers, and may I take all their harm and pain secretly upon myself. So, all joy and help to my mothers. Because we have been cycling endlessly through samsara since beginningless time in so many different forms, up, down, every way we can think of. At some point, all sentient beings have been my mother. This is the idea. We don't recognize it now. We only remember our mother for this lifetime. But our mother in our last lifetime, who was she? Our mother in our next lifetime, who knows? So, considering how much, I mean, the whole concept of Buddhism is that we are trapped on this endless cycle of birth, rebirth, re-death, rebirth, re-death, endlessly. And so during all that time, in so many different forms and so many different realms of samsara, at some point or other, we must have been intimately related with everybody, only we just don't remember anymore. So, just as in Asia, people love their mothers, and even if their mother was not a very nice mother, they love them anyway. Unlike here, where everybody blames their mothers. Everybody loves their mothers. And so the mother was given as the example of the one person that we would really wish would be free from suffering and would be well and happy. I mean, everybody, you know, if they have a healthy relationship with their mothers, would wish them to be well and happy, don't want them to suffer. And so that feeling of warmth and caring that we would give to our mother in this lifetime, we can extend to all sentient beings because at some point or other, we were in that same intimate relationship with them. That's the idea. So therefore, in brief, directly or indirectly, indirectly means if you see somebody who needs help, we help them. Indirectly means that even if we are not actually in their presence, which is true of most sentient beings, we can nonetheless do meditations on wishing them well and happy. You know, the meditations on metta, on loving kindness and on compassion. In that way, we send it out to all beings. So they are indirectly affected by our wish for their well-being. So, in brief, directly or indirectly, may I give all help and joy to my mothers, and may I take in all their harm and pain secretly upon myself. So, again, this is the practice which those of you who were here this morning for the end of the retreat will recognize. It's the practice of Tonglen. Of sending and receiving. Who here doesn't know Tonglen? Well, in general, Tonglen is the practice where one visualizes taking in, I mean, one thinks of a person that is suffering. Do we start by thinking of a person who is suffering, either physically or mentally? Then with the in-breath, taking in all their suffering and the causes of their suffering, not just the physical causes, but also the karmic causes of their suffering, into oneself in the form of a dark light. You just visualize all this dark light with the in-breath. With our inhalation, we take in from that person all the darkness of their sickness or their suffering, their mental suffering, their emotional suffering, physical suffering, whatever, into ourselves in the form of dark light. It hits this little bead or pearl, a black, very black pearl of our self-cherishing mind, of our ego, which doesn't want others suffering. Very sorry for you, but I don't want your suffering. And so by deliberately bringing in their suffering with the wish for them to be released from it, and I will take it in on myself, that crushes that little sense of ego which doesn't want anybody's suffering, anyone else. And then it dissolves and immediately is replaced by either a very bright bead, pearl, or a diamond, which on the out-breath, so this is happening on the in and out-breath, on the out-breath, a very bright light comes out, which is coming from our essential Buddha nature, our essential nature of the mind, our nirvanic level of consciousness, which never can be polluted by suffering. It is eternally blissful and healthy, cannot be anything else. It is the unconditioned, and that is never polluted by the conditioned. So, and with the out-breath comes the light, which then soaks into the person that one is visualizing or who one sees in front of one. Say, if you go to a hospital, somebody's very sick, you can just sit there very quietly doing this meditation. Bringing in the dark, sending out the light. So, but secretly, you don't have to tell the people, I'm doing this for you. You don't have to tell anybody what you're doing. I mean, if you are in a hospital room, you don't have to sit in a special posture. You just sit. Nobody knows what you're doing. We don't draw attention to our practices. Even, as I said, in a bus or a train or a plane, we can do Tonglen. We can just take in all the suffering of all these beings sitting there and give them out light and love. Because all beings have been our mother at some time. All beings, anyway, if you don't want them as your mother, you can at least accept that all beings would like to be well and happy and free from suffering. And every single person has problems. Be sure. If it's not one thing, it's something else. If it's not their personal problem, it's somebody close to them that they're worrying about. So just imagine taking all that in. How wonderful if I could take in all their suffering and give them joy and happiness and well-being. Wouldn't that be wonderful? Oh, I'm sure any of us would be happy to do that. I mean, even just here, if we could take everybody's suffering into ourselves, just me, and give them out joy. I mean, that would be a very, very fair bargain. You know? And they don't have to know that's what you're thinking. So rather than just feeling sort of, you know, in the face of suffering, just feeling very helpless, apart from anything material which we can do to help, you know, inwardly, spiritually, psychologically, we can do these practices. And if we do it sincerely, it really does change the atmosphere. Many people coming out say, whoa, you know, something's changed. And also for the person, if like you're in front of someone who's sick, they also feel something, you know. They don't know what's happened, but they feel better inside themselves. Our thoughts have tremendous power. I think this is very important to remember. I lived for many years in the hills behind the pilgrimage town of Assisi, where San Francisco came from. And of course, nowadays it's all nicely tarted up and is a big pilgrimage place. I mean, you know, people who go to Italy, they go to Rome, Florence, Assisi, and Venice. So it's full of all these, you know, shops selling tourists and pilgrim junk. And, you know, I mean, it's full of tourists. But nonetheless, because it was the home of St. Francis and St. Clair, and for centuries and centuries and centuries, people went there on pilgrimage and still go there on pilgrimage. It has a very powerful feeling there. I mean, there are many beautiful medieval towns in Umbria and Tuscany, but Assisi is something very special, even now, despite all the commercialism. And I've met a number of people who have told me that when they went to Assisi on the tourist, you know, route, suddenly they had, out of the blue, very deep spiritual experience. And they weren't expecting that at all. They weren't into any particular, you know, Dharma trip or anything. They were just, you know, backpacking through Europe. But again and again, people say, and only in Assisi, that they found that suddenly something shifted inside them. And they had very, sometimes, life-changing experiences there. On the other hand, Bodh Gaya, of course. I mean, Bodh Gaya is in the midst of, oh God. You know, I mean, any of you who have been to Bihar, you know what we're talking about. I mean, it really is on one level almost a hell realm, and certainly a hungry ghost realm. And so around it is all this incredible, not just poverty, but violence. It's a very, very unstable state. It's the poorest and the most violent state in India. And in the middle of it is Bodh Gaya, right, with a little wall around it. But as you go into Bodh Gaya, you're like you're in a pure realm. especially in the early morning or in the evening when all the tourists have gone, it's an extraordinary place. It has so much energy because of the thoughts and aspirations of all the people gathered there from all over the world, praying and prostrating. And of course, the Buddha attained enlightenment there. So it has this very, very powerful energy. And you, even you don't know what it is, you know it's something. And likewise, if you go, say, to Auschwitz or any of these kind of places where something awful happened, if you go to Auschwitz, there's nothing there. I mean, they're just buildings and photos of the people who went there. But, you know, nothing, just buildings. And yeah, you just know it's so heavy. The feeling of fear and grief is just palpable. Because of all the awful things which happened and the pain of all the people who visit there now. So you know something horrible happened there. So what I'm saying is that the outer form might not be anything threatening or anything special, but the mind force there is the energy of that place, depending on whether the energy is something very positive, full of love, devotion, or something very negative, full of fear and hate. It's there. So we should be careful with our thoughts. Please, all of you here in this country at this moment, there's a lot of fear, there's a lot of paranoia, there's a lot of anger. Please don't plug into that. In the face of anger and fear, give loving kindness and compassion. Please. You don't need to plug in and increase the paranoia. It doesn't help. Actually, it is just increasing the problem. So what we all need to do is to replace that negative energy by positive energy. Send out loving kindness. Cover the whole country, the whole globe with golden light of love and healing. Not sending out more and more dark energy. Please. Our thoughts have power. So make it a positive power, not a negative power. Fearless compassion. May none of this ever be sullied by thoughts of the eight worldly concerns. May I understand all things as illusions and, without attachment, gain freedom from bondage. So, may none of this ever be sullied, or the above, by thoughts of the eight worldly concerns. So the eight worldly concerns are gain and loss, pain and pleasure, criticism and blame, and fame and disrepute. So everybody wants to gain and be praised and have pleasure and a good reputation. And we all want to avoid loss and criticism and blame and pain and a bad reputation and so forth. So the point is that therefore we should not be caught between these two opposites, these worldly aims. Why are we doing something? Well, so that then people will like us and they will say nice things about us and we'll be known for our piety and we'll be, you know, so forth. And then, you know, people, it will be very nice and pleasant and everybody will love us and so forth. That's not the reasons. Likewise, because we're afraid, we do something because we're afraid otherwise people will criticize us or create problems for us and so forth. That is not the reason. We shouldn't be caught up, especially gain and loss, pleasure and pain. That's not our motivation. So we shouldn't practice in order to impress others or that we think that therefore people will like us more or any of these kind of self-aggrandizing emotions and motives. Our motives should be purely for the sake of benefiting others and ourselves awakening to the ultimate. That's all. Not so that people would think, you know, think better of us or think worse of us or whatever like that. That's not the point. It's not about inflating our ego. So this is very important. You know, what is our motivation? Well, as human beings, we have what we have. But the point is that we should really dedicate our lives for benefiting ourselves, but also benefiting others. It doesn't mean that we only benefit others and we ignore ourselves. We have to breathe in as well as breathing out. If we're only breathing out, but we're never breathing in, we're going to be asphyxiated very quickly. And this often happens with people who are in very demanding jobs and social work and so forth, or in very traumatic kind of professions. They are so kind that, again, they get out of balance and feel guilty if they give themselves any time or any love. They feel, if I'm kind to myself, that is self-cherishing, and I should only be thinking of others. But then it gets all out of balance again. It's, you know, there are those who think only about themselves and could care less about others. Others can take care of themselves. It's me. And others who feel, as I say, guilty because of low self-esteem and feel that they have to only give, and never take care of themselves. That is very unbalanced. And in the end, we just burn out. So it's very important that we balance taking care of ourselves so that we are able to be strong in taking care of others. It's like this glass of water. I mean, if I keep pouring out and out and out, but I never fill up, it's going to be an empty glass. Or like with your computer apps, if you're always using them and you never recharge, then it's going to go flat. And so a lot of people go flat because they forget to recharge. And so we need to recharge also our batteries, you know, by doing some retreats, by doing things which help us to relax, which give us pleasure and make us laugh, because we don't want to take ourselves too seriously, right? We all want to lighten up, don't we? So the point is, we have to, in order to walk the path, we have to be balanced. This is why the Buddha said that we start by giving loving kindness and compassion to ourselves. This is very important. If we don't give loving kindness to ourselves, how are we going to give loving kindness to others? First, we have to fill up. Buddhism is very good at ego bashing. It's always going on about, you know, the dangers of the ego, of the self, and self-cherishing mind, and so forth. This is because, as I said at the beginning, on the whole, in Buddhist countries, people do not suffer from a low self-esteem crisis. They feel pretty good about themselves, so therefore they can afford to now put out more effort towards helping others. But for some very strange reason, really, because in the West, everybody has so much compared with what they have in other places, including education. But nonetheless, people often have a very fragile sense of self. And at the time of the Buddha, so this is going back 2.5 millennia, the Buddha said, we start with giving loving kindness, compassion, and empathetic joy to ourselves. Now, who are we giving loving kindness to? We are not giving loving kindness to our Buddha nature. Our Buddha nature already is loving kindness. So who are we sending loving kindness to, and who is sending that loving kindness? Me. I am sending loving kindness to me. Even though, ultimately, the ego is an illusion, in the meantime, we need to have a confident, strong sense of self in order to walk the path. Merely saying, I have no ego. Who is saying I have no ego? The ego. Merely bashing up our ego, flagellating it every time it tries to reach its head. Who is doing that? The ego. Do you understand? I mean, it's very important. The Buddha saw it very clearly. He didn't enunciate it this way, but if you look at his path, it starts with shamatha meditation, which is to make the mind very quiet and calm and healthy in order to go into the various levels of spiritual absorption called the jhanas. All the mental factors, all the psychic factors have to be in balance. Then it opens up. We have to get the right configuration. When everything is healthy and balanced, then it will naturally happen. Without that, it can't happen. So shamatha is for healing the mind, for getting all our psychological factors well balanced, so that we are able, with vipassana, to unpeel the onion, layer by layer. If our sense of self is unhealthy and in pain, we cannot take off the layers. It would be actually psychologically very destructive. We have to be strong, with clear insight and a very well-balanced interior in order to gain that laser beam of insight into the nature of our empty, luminous mind. So therefore, it's very important with all these texts to take them in context. But the real message is that even difficulties can be taken and used if we have that inner strength, which comes from recognizing that all these difficulties which we face are means for us to progress and to inwardly grow up. If we are happy when things go right, and depressed and frustrated when things go wrong, or get angry when people do things we don't like, and are all loving and sweet when people do things we do like, then essentially we are still on the level of a 2-year-old. 2-year-olds are all smiles and dimples when things go the way they want them, and they have temper tantrums the minute they don't. And so then we grow up and we get older and older and more wrinkles, but inside we're often still 2-year-olds. When things go right, we're all nice and friendly, and when things do not go right, we're all upset and angry and, you know, depressed. We're having tantrums inside, even though outwardly we still might be, you know, we might not display it like children anymore, but inwardly the same reaction is going on. Happy when people do what I want, upset when they don't. Like children. The Buddha always said we have to mature, we have to grow up, we have to become adults. So all of these practices are for helping us to transform our normal responses and attitude, thinking when things go right, that's good, when things are difficult, that's bad. Maybe those things which we name as difficult and bad are the best things which could have happened to us. As I say, this is not some, you know, kind of feel-good New Age philosophy. This is fairly basic Buddha Dharma. Only the ego is saying whether something is good or not good, based on the pleasure-pain principle. Sometimes the worst things have actually turned out to be the best things. So, may none of this ever be sullied by thoughts of the 8 worldly concerns. May I understand all things as illusions, and without attachment, gain freedom from bondage. So, illusions, the world that we perceive as being so real and as being separate from ourselves, is compared in the traditional texts to be like an illusion, like a dream, like a mirage, like a rainbow, and so forth. In other words, they are things which appear to be exactly how they are, but actually we can never grasp the thing in themselves. They have always come together because of causes and conditions. But in themselves they have no ultimate reality. So this is how they try to explain to us that what we seems to us to be very real, all of you sitting there, actually, on a very much deeper level, in one way, you're just projections of my own consciousness, just as I'm a projection of your consciousness. Doesn't mean you don't exist at all. Obviously, we do, just as we do exist, but we don't exist the way we think we exist. Recently, we met with this neuroscientist who was also saying, actually, almost everything which appears in our consciousness as a reality isn't real. And more and more nowadays, neuroscientists are adding to the percentage of what our brain mechanism adds to the bare input which comes through our sense doors, that it's more and more fabricated brilliantly by our mind in accordance with the kind of brain, sense organs and karma which we have and which we share as human beings. if we had different sense organs and a different mechanism, we would see things very differently. We see things the way we do. The Buddha himself said that the universe is created by the karma of all the beings who inhabit it. In other words, everybody is creating their own universe, actually. Why His Holiness the Dalai Lama is so fascinated by neuroscience is because they are now replicating wisdom which was known thousands of years ago in India. That actually what we perceive is not self-existent from its own side in the way that we perceive it. I'm not going to go into philosophy at this point. But anyway, the idea is that the closest you can say is that, for example, when we are asleep and we have dreams, then if that dream is a vivid dream, we really believe it and our body also believes it. If it's a frightening dream, our heart will pound and so forth. And I'm sure many of you have seen dogs who are dreaming and their legs are churning because they imagine they're racing somebody or something's chasing them. And so their body believes the dream, which the mind is giving. But when we wake up from that dream, then we think, oh, that was just a dream. Now this is real. But from the point of view of Buddhism and also from the point of view of Vedanta, this is still just a dream. When we wake to our primordial, pure awareness, our nirvanic consciousness, our Buddha nature, Dharmakaya, whatever you want to call it, then the ordinary conceptual thinking consciousness which we normally have, which is by its very nature dualistic, there's subject and object, is completely transcended. It's very simple. But it's totally non-dual. And we see things how they really are rather than how it is presented to us through our conceptual thinking mind. This is why the word Buddha means to awake. So although we often translate Bodhi as enlightenment, it really means to wake up. So what we're all trying to do is waking up. Wake up from the sleep, the dream of our ignorance, of our illusion, of our not seeing things as they really are. So all Buddhist schools are concerned with waking up. All Buddhist schools. How to wake up. And at the same time, how to open up the heart to embrace all beings with loving kindness and compassion. So, when we see things how they really are, there is no ego. The ego is creating the movie which we then attach to, believing the movie to be real. Once we realize the movie is just a movie, we are no longer attached. Whatever happens, oh, that's fun. Laugh, laugh, cry, cry. Different movies are different, but it's just a movie. It's not real. Then we are not attached to the outcome. We can enjoy it, but we don't believe it. So, he says, may I understand all things as illusions and without attachment gain freedom from bondage. The bondage is the bondage of the ego. Once we have gone beyond the ego and recognize the ultimate nature of the mind, then we have no attachment and we are free from bondage. Amen. Okay, well, that's pretty good. I got there. Okay, so Jambo bawo jira jamba dang kundo sambo de ande shin de de da kunji ju su da lo ching ke wa de da tan ji ra tu ngo chan jo sen jo rin bo je ma che pa nan je ju ji che wa nyam pa me pa yang go ne gong do pe wa shu. Thank you all. Thank you.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.